This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live upon the earth. And as I always say, it's so vital for all people on the planet, because there's no greater threat than Jewish supremacism. And it's so vital to understand the dynamics of this conflict between Jew and Gentile. We read so much about anti-Semitism, and yet almost all of what we read in our mass media is absolutely dictated by Jewish extremists and supremacists themselves. They define anti-Semitism, and they never give an opposite viewpoint or a comparison viewpoint of the phenomena of so-called anti-Semitism. As you know, I'm doing my book, Jewish Supremacism, in an audio format. And I'm working on it right now, and we're trying to complete this book over the air and broadcast free for all of you to hear in my broadcasts. When it's done, we will actually sell the book, but right now you can hear the book absolutely free, and I think that you very much enjoy the fantastic research and extensive documentation that's in this book. So we're going now into the second part of the eighth chapter. That's the origins of anti-Semitism, crime, and treachery. And today we talk about the role of Jews in organized crime historically, in what's called the Russian organized crime gangs. Also, the fact that the organized criminals literally control a lot of the media that reports on organized crime and helps hide the Jewish role from the people of our respective countries. And we're going to go into the slave trade, a very important issue. The Europeans have certainly been given their share of guilt for slavery. We often hear how whites enslaved blacks and other minorities around the world. The interesting thing is that Jews, over the past 2,000 years at least, have dominated the slave trade. But, of course, there's no collective guilt for Jews in that regard. And I'm going to quote from many major Jewish historians on this subject, information that they know about, but you're not allowed to know about. So here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope all of you are still aware of what's going on and following closely the terrible events that are happening in Lebanon. Our hearts go out to the Lebanese people. And we must realize that Jewish supremacism is a threat, not just to Lebanon, but to all people, and certainly to the people of the United States of America, to Britain, and the rest of the world. In fact, the terrorism that was plotted in Britain against the airliners going to the United States, this wouldn't be taking place except for this war, this clash of civilization, which has been launched by these Jewish extremists over the last 20 or 30 years. That's what's happening. They have fomented this war. They want this war, and they see it as something that is advantageous to Jewish strategic objectives. And certainly it has been, but it certainly has not been advantageous to us. How many more 9/11s must we suffer in the West because of Jewish domination of our foreign policy and our intervention in the Middle East and really our support of the suppressive criminal state of Israel? Well, ladies and gentlemen, here we go. This is the second part of Chapter 8, The Origins of Anti-Semitism, Crime, and Treachery. Now, in looking into the history of Jewish criminal behavior, I found many historical figures and chroniclers who feared Jewish criminal organizations. Now, if this volume could afford the space, the below sampling could expand 100-fold. Let me quote from a few. Roman statesmen. Marcus Cicero. Flaccus, a friend who was a customs official, found himself persecuted for stopping the illegal flow of gold from Rome to Jerusalem. Cicero, in defending Flaccus, condemns such early smuggling and money laundering and the efforts to intimidate an honest public official from doing his duty. He says, "Softly, softly, I want none but the judges to hear me. The Jews have already got me into a fine mess, as they have many other gentlemen. Here's first century Roman philosopher Lucius Seneca. He referred to the Jews as, quote, that most criminal nation. Napoleon. He said, the Jews are the master robbers of the modern age. They are the carrion birds of humanity. We ought to ban the Jews from commerce because they abuse it. Quote. Daniel Defoe. The works Roxana, Robinson Crusoe, and the military memoirs of Captain George Carleton have frequent allusions to greedy and unprincipled criminal Jews who stock in trade is fenced stolen articles. William Prime. Puritan writer opposing Cromwell's effort to allow the Jews back in England describes Jewish offenses as usuries and deceits, clippings, and falsifying monies. And that's from a short demurrer to the Jews' long-discontinued remitter into England. Charles Dickens, one of the icons of English literature, had the classic characterization of the criminal Jew, Fagin, in Oliver Twist. The character would enlist Gentile children to pickpocketry an assortment of similar criminal enterprises. And of course, the Roman historian Tacitus, who said, among themselves, they are inflexibly honest and ever ready to show compassion, though they regard the rest of mankind with all the hatred of enemies. And boy, when I read that, I think about what's happening in Lebanon right now. There is much evidence of a Jewish-dominated criminal underworld that has existed for hundreds of years. One of the most amazing things I discovered was a book published at the time of Protestant reformer Martin Luther. Europe was so plagued by organized crime that the authorities felt compelled to publish a lexicon of criminal terms. Luther supported its publication as a means of fighting crime and wrote an introduction to the lexicon in which he noted that the vocabulary of criminals was full of Hebrew words. In the preface, Luther wrote, quote, I consider it useful that this book be widely read, so that it may be seen and understood how the devil rules this world, so that men may be wise against him. It is true that the rough Welsha Sprache, underworld slang, comes from the Jews, for it contains many Hebrew words, as those who know Hebrew well observe. Next section, when criminals control the media. The fact that so few Gentiles are aware of the long and integral relationship between Jews and organized crime is due to their enormous power in media that shields them from the image that Italians have in relation to the mafia. It is perhaps typified in the interconnectivity of Jewish organized crime in Russia and Jewish media power there. For instance, two of the leading organized crime figures there are Berezovsky and Vladimir Kuczynski. Both are media moguls in Russia, having enormous power in TV, radio, newspapers, and magazines. Kuczynski was recently indicted by the Russian prosecutor's office for corruption and money laundering. In 1999, Berezovsky seized control of Moscow's TV6 television station. Russia's premier daily newspaper, The Kommersant, was also acquired by Berezovsky, and he promptly fired its editor, Raf Shakirov, who said that, quote, his ouster is an attempt to curb often critical coverage of the tycoon's business and political activities. Forbes magazine published a scathing article about Berezovsky entitled, quote, The Godfather of the Kremlin, with no byline because of fear of violence against its authors. The magazine's editor, James Michaels, said that Berezovsky, quote, stands tall as one of the most powerful men in Russia. Behind him lies a trail of corpses, uncollected debts, and competitors terrified for their lives. The Forbes article asserted, and I quote, assassination is a tool of business competition. Scores of business leaders and media personalities have been killed. Berezovsky controls Russia's biggest TV network. His control was solidified shortly after the first chairman of the network was assassinated gangland style. Berezovsky was immediately fingered by the police as a key suspect, but the murder remains unsolved 2 years later. Such is the Russian business environment today that the men at the top have use for the shadowy army of killers and thugs who work further down in the scale of corruption, running prostitute and protection rackets. Incredibly, in 1996, Berezovsky became a member of the Kremlin Security Council and privy to the most sensitive information of Russia. It was also revealed by the Moscow Times newspaper that Putin used to take his holidays at Berezovsky's summer home in Moscow. Yet, even for Putin, Berezovsky's blatant murder and racketeering was too much. The Russian prosecutor is now pursuing him for criminal indictment. Both Berezovsky and Gusinski, now on the run from authorities, are screaming that they're simply victims of, quote, anti-Semitism. The relationship between Jewish organized power, organized crime, media, and government power is crystal clear in the former Soviet Union. Just as they seized power in 1917 as Bolsheviks, they have now seized power at the fall of communism through corruption and organized crime. Fortune magazine ran an article entitled Russia's Robber Barons, profiling 10 of the most important Russian business tycoons and mobsters who've catapulted to economic dominance in Russia with the collapse of communism. These included Gusinski, Berezovsky, Boris Haight, Mikhail Friedman, Vladimir Vinogradov, Vladimir Potanin, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Alexander Smolensky, and Pyotr Avin. It's estimated that more than 50% of Russia's raw wealth is owned by these 10 men. And of course, since the time of the writing of this book, many of these individuals have been prosecuted by the Russian government, including very actively by Vladimir Putin. Now, while the average Russian barely survives on less than an average of $200 per month, enormous wealth and power has been concentrated in the hands of a tiny group of men loyal not to the Russian people, but only to their tribe. These men certainly did not earn the vast wealth that they accumulated in only 3 or 4 years after the demise of communism. It was acquired through fraud, corruption, bribery, theft, and murder. The world knows almost nothing about the Jewish character of this theft of practically an entire nation, because the Jewish media in Russia and in the rest of the world has chosen to keep this vital fact from our consciousness. 9 out of the 10 leading robber barons of Russia listed by Fortune magazine are in fact Jews. With the demise of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, we now have a huge case of fraud going back between Russia and Israel, where most of the stolen money from this corporation has ended up in Israel. The next section is the slave trade. And I begin this section with a quotation from Leviticus, right from the Old Testament. This is Leviticus 25, 44, and 46. And listen to this quotation very carefully. As for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are round about you. 46. You may bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit as a possession forever. You may make slaves of them, but over your own brethren, the people of Israel, you shall not rule one over another with harshness. So, here's the quotation from the Old Testament very clearly, that you're allowed to enslave non-Jews and keep them as your inheritance forever, forever. And at the same time, you're not allowed to enslave your fellow Jews. Although the institution of slavery existed throughout most of human history, trade in human flesh has never been looked upon as a noble occupation. Compassionate men and women have long decried cruel mistreatment of slaves, especially of women and children, by slaveholders and traders. Many agreed with Christ's admonitions to slaveholders to treat their slaves kindly. In contrast to the benevolent image assigned to them by the media, Jews historically dominated an international institution that embodied the darkest evils of human exploitation, the slave trade. My introduction into the important Jewish role in slave trading came from an article about Jews written by a leading Jewish historian and apologist, Jacob Marcus. The article was written in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Marcus casually remarked about the Jewish control of commerce in the Middle Ages, particularly the slave trade. Quote, "In the Dark Ages, the commerce of Western Europe was largely in the Jews' hand, in particular, the slave trade." Unquote. The Jewish mastery of the slave trade did not go unnoticed to Christian writers in the Middle Ages. I read poignant accounts of European children who suffered sexual and other abuses from Jewish slave traders who acquired them. In Roman times, they often followed the path of the conquering Roman army and enslaved enemy soldiers and civilians. Chroniclers of the ancient and medieval periods wrote of their preference for fair women and children, and of their frequent sale in the Levant. The Jewish slavers were more than happy to satisfy darker men's taste for white flesh. Horrified by reports of abuse of Christian women and children by Jews, a number of Christian principalities issued edicts detailing these abuses and forbidding Jews to own or trade in Christian women and children. Jews, in writing their own histories, have matter-of-factly acknowledged the Jewish role in slave trading, looking at it as simply an extremely lucrative Jewish commercial venture. In A History of the Jew, From Babylonian Exile to the End of World War II, published by the Jewish Publication Society of America, the author writes very emphatically, quote, "Jews were among the most important slave dealers in European society." It really surprised me when I found out that Jews played a prominent role in American slavery. In the early 1970s, I came across a book called Who Brought the Slaves to America by Walter White. I could understand the role of Jews in the slave trade of the Mediterranean region, but it seemed unlikely to me that the very small Jewish population in the early American colonies could dominate such a large enterprise. I also retained, at that time, Hollywood's image of white men, perhaps even Southerners, sailing to Africa and rounding up black natives for the slave trade. In movies, articles, and books, slavers were Anglo-Saxons with names like Smith or Jones. Usually they were hard-drinking, uncouth Southern types. Later I learned that slavery was ubiquitous in Africa among native blacks themselves, and that they were seldom rounded up by whites. Usually, black African slaveholders were the ones who sold them to the slaveholders who brought them to the Americas. Who Brought the Slaves to America steered me to the library collections that house the records of slave ships, contemporary accounts, and a number of Jewish historians who documented the role Jews have played in slavery. The Jewish writers I read were prideful in their accounts of the great Jewish slave traders. A good example in point is Mark Raphael's Jews and Judaism in the United States, a Documentary History. And I quote, "Jewish merchants played a major role in the slave trade. In fact, in all the American colonies, whether French, Martinique, British, or Dutch, Jewish merchants frequently dominated. This was no less true on the North American mainland, where during the 18th century, Jews participated in the triangular trade that brought slaves from Africa to the West Indies and there exchanged them for molasses, which in turn was taken to New England and converted into rum for sale in Africa. Isaac da Costa of Charleston in the 1750s, David Franks of Philadelphia in the 1760s, and Aaron Lopez of Newport in the late 1760s and early 1770s dominated Jewish slave trading on the American continent. In North America, the slave trade had its most powerful center in Newport, Rhode Island. Now, Newport formed a pivotal part of the triangular slave trade of rum and molasses from New England to Africa for slaves and back to the West Indies and the colonies with the human cargo. I discovered it was no coincidence that Newport, the center of the slave trade, had the oldest synagogue in America and the largest thriving Jewish community in the entire American colonies. Aaron Lopez, a Portuguese Jew of Murano descent and a resident of Newport, was one of the most powerful slave traders in the Americas. He owned dozens of ships and imported thousands of blacks into the Western Hemisphere. In an account of just two voyages of one of Lopez's ships, the Cleopatra, at least 250 blacks perished. Now, such horrendous loss of life and such a dirty business did not prevent Jewish chronicler Jacob Marcus from praising Lopez. Quote, "What can be said about this most attractive figure?" Unquote. Although Lopez acquired riches in the colonies, he violated the anti-British non-importation trade agreements during the Revolutionary period, supporting British interests rather than the colonies. Now, Jews dominated the slave trade not only in the American colonies, but all over the New World. In a major Jewish history of the early Americas called, quote, New World Jewry, 1492 to 1776, one can find the following passage. "They came with ships carrying African blacks to be sold as slaves. The traffic in slaves was a royal monopoly, and the Jews were often appointed as agents for the crown in their sale. They were the largest ship chandlers in the entire Caribbean region, where the shipping business was mainly a Jewish enterprise. The ships were not only owned by Jews, but were manned by Jewish crews and sailed under the command of Jewish captains." Unquote. Many Jewish writers chronicle the Jewish role in slavery, often boasting of their shrewdness in that business. The West India Company, which monopolized imports of slaves from Africa, sold slaves at public auctions against cash payment. It happened that cash was mostly in the hands of Jews. The buyers who appeared at the auctions were almost always Jews, and because of this lack of competitors, they could buy slaves at low prices. On the other hand, there was also no competition in the selling of the slaves to the plantation owners and other buyers, and most of them purchased on credit payable at the next harvest in sugar. Profits of up to 300% of purchase value were often realized with high interest rates. If it happened that the date of such an auction fell on a Jewish holiday, the auction had to be postponed, and this occurred on Friday, October 21, 1644. Unquote. Although certainly indefensible by today's moral standards, slavery in the United States was many times preferable to the incredibly cruel and murderous conditions of African slavery. The greatest inhumanity of black slavery is associated with the passage to America. Some say that 10 to 15% of black slaves died in the cramped and filthy conditions on the ships. Since the Jews have dominated the slave trade from ancient times, I realized that it's not only blacks who have suffered from the inhuman conditions, but also untold numbers of white people of the Mediterranean region. It should also be pointed out that not only were Jews the principal slave traders, they had a markedly higher per capita holding of slaves than non-Jews. Quote, "All through the 18th century into the early 19th, Jews in the North were to own black servants. In the South, the few plantations owned by Jews were tilled with slave labor. In 1820, over 75% of all Jewish families in Charleston, Richmond, and Savannah owned slaves employed as domestic servants. Almost 40% of all Jewish householders in the United States owned one slave or more. There were no protests against slavery as such by Jews in the South, where they were always outnumbered at least 100 to 1. Very few Jews anywhere in the United States protested against chattel slavery on moral grounds." Again, this is from Jewish sources. Now, considering that less than 10% of all colonists own slaves, Marcus revealed that individual Jewish households, 40% own slaves, were far more likely to own slaves than were Gentiles. With their comparatively greater numbers in the Mediterranean world, Jews constituted disproportionate slaveholders in the ancient and medieval world, just as they were in the colonies. The importation of slaves to America is a relatively recent historical phenomenon that lasted about 200 years. From before the time of Christ to the African trade of the 1700s, most of the slaves owned and bartered by Jews were white. When I learned of the Jewish role in the slave trade, it seemed to me that it could have certainly added to the resentment against the Jews felt by their host populations. Being known as the greatest perpetrators of the slave trade is not the best of public relations for Jews. It is no wonder that the Jewish-dominated media have avoided the issue. Only Jewish scholars who faithfully record Jewish history, primarily for Jewish readers, are allowed to travel on such forbidden historical ground. And by the way, I have a picture in the book of the cover of Newsweek, The Long Shadow of Slavery, and it has an article headlined, Spielberg's Controversial New Movie. And my caption is, Steven Spielberg's movie about the slave trade in Newport, Rhode Island, where it's centered, makes no mention of the predominant Jewish role in the slave trade. Now, after my first efforts on national television in the early 1970s to expose the Jewish role in slave trading, on PBS, Black Perspectives in the News, the Nation of Islam also did extensive research on the issue. The Historical Research Department came up with a tremendous amount of documented material on the subject that they published in the book called The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. Today, simply by repeating the words of prominent Jewish historians on the Jewish role in slavery, one becomes guilty of, quote, anti-Semitism, unquote. It was only when the public began to learn some of the little-known facts previously reserved for Jewish scholars that the ADL found it necessary to counter such anti-Semitic propaganda. The ADL and other Jewish organizations have responded by trotting out a number of prestigious Jewish scholars who have publicly announced that the Jewish role in the colonial slave trade was minimal. In Spielberg's blockbuster movie on the slave trade, Amistad, there was hardly a Jew to be found in the film, although the Jews dominated the Newport, Rhode Island slave trade. All the slavers in the film seemed conspicuously Christian. A number of articles that discussed Amistad and slave trading, including Time and Newsweek, went out of their way to deny a major Jewish role in slave trading. Unfortunately, most of their readers were not told what prominent Jewish historians themselves wrote about the matter before it became an embarrassing public issue. Few will read the words of the editor of the magazine of the American Jewish Historical Society, Jewish merchants played a major role in the slave trade. In fact, in all the American colonies, whether French, Martinique, British, or Dutch, Jewish merchants frequently dominated. This is no less true on the North American mainland. Unquote. Well, folks, that's the end of the second part of the eighth chapter. And that's, of course, the roots of anti-Semitism, Jewish involvement in organized crime and treachery. As you can see, there is quite a different reality in terms of the conflict between Jews and Gentiles than what the Jewish extremists and supremacists write about for our consumption in the media of the United States and really around the world. There's a double-sided sword here. There's a sword of anti-Semitism, but also a sword of anti-Gentilism and disreputable activities of an enormous nature. In the next section, we will talk about the white slave trade. And I will talk about Mr. Bristow, who's a Jewish researcher, who writes about the Jewish domination of this trade for many, many centuries, and the latest expression of this trade, which has enslaved hundreds of thousands of primarily Eastern European girls in slave rings, white slave rings, headquartered in Israel. It's a shocking story. We'll continue on with that, and I look forward to being with you tomorrow. Until then, please help me spread this word, support our effort, support our work. We need your help to do what we must do at www.davidduke.com, what I do with the Duke Report and what I do with my lectures and work around the world. Thanks so much for that support and for spreading the word to your family and friends. One person at a time, we can change the world. Thanks again.
This has been a David Duke worldwide web radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddu.com.